Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Matters, the show in which I discuss all matters of the mind, in which I show how much mind matters. Welcome to part 40 of Control Your Brain, Control Your Life. I am Udo Staatsbrücker and I'm live on air. You can call in at any time with questions and comments on the subject I'm talking about. If you have any questions, comments, and suggestions not related to the subject matter, please go to my website mindmattersonline.info. mindmattersonline is one word. There you'll find my email address and then write to me. I will reply within 48 hours. The same, of course, applies also if you cannot get through with your calls to this show. On my website, you will find also the last 20 or so recordings of my show and a link that directs you to the Blog Talk Radio archive, in which you'll find all my shows, old and new, listened to at your leisure. Before I go into our today's theme, I want you to become aware of one very important thing. Whatever I've been talking about over the past weeks and months, about health issues, about changing the way you think, being in control of your thoughts, and almost everything else, it is only useful for you or attainable to you if you have a very high level of self-confidence and assertiveness and self-esteem. These are the foundations for everything we want to achieve, whether it is material success or great relationship, or happiness, the greatest good of all, or being in control. Without this confidence, it's just not going to happen. In view of this, I've written a book entitled Life Mastery, Book 1, in which I lay out the tools and explain the mechanics of how to become assertive and self-confident and everything else that belongs to the foundation of life mastery or self-actualization, as I called it in some of my programs. Go to my website and on page 3, which is titled Books, believe it or not, you will find it together with an access code to create space where you can order it at a very reasonable price of $10.95. But now to the theme of today. Last week, I ran out of time before I could finish, and therefore I'm coming back to this theme in this show. Before I was told that I had to end the show, I was talking about vitality and that your vitality for life comes more alive with more energy when you fully embrace your true nature as a weak, fallible, and mortal person. And that you need to accept this as a fact, because acceptance is always the first step to change something. And secondly, we cannot change that we are mere mortals anyway. Therefore, we can accept this as a fact and become very relaxed about it. Vitality emerges from your needs, not in spite of them. So what do you need? What are the requirements of life that activate your full mind, body, and emotions? People become empty and out of touch with themselves when they don't know their true needs and try to live in some synthetic life that Wall Street or Hollywood or some magazine or some cultural bureau of standards impose on their lives. Then they live by external values, by the clock, by brand names, by what others are telling them they should think or should feel, should experience. Now, how sad is that? If you're tired of being diminished, devitalized, and living like a zombie, then I'd recommend discovering who you are in your lower level needs and drives, and find out how to gratify them adequately and accurately for yourself. If you're tired of seeing yourself as a victim of disease, as a typical patient according to my definition, then I recommend discovering your real strength and your real powers. Achieving all that, you can then move on to discovering who you are in your higher level needs, your being needs, and again, find out how to gratify them so that it brings out your best and fulfills your real nature. Once you have reached this point, you have made a gigantic step toward life mastery. Life mastery, however, is not an end. It is not a destination. It is the point where we begin to determine our life and where we really and truly influence our health and well-being. One of the very important tools to achieve this state of mind is, of course, language. The words that you use and how you string them together in forming sentences. I'm not talking about grammar and syntax, of course, but about one of my favorite subjects, how to use language to influence not only others, but also yourself. One way to change old patterns of thinking, talking, and doing is to completely remove the verb to be in all its forms from your language. It turns out that the use of the verb to be alone may be responsible for a great deal of faulty reasoning we commonly find. Intentionally or not, people tend to abuse the verb, perpetuating a way of thinking that hinders proper critical thinking and consequently acting accordingly. I have said so many times in my programs that language influences the way we think and also the way we act. Language impacts thinking and doing. Think about how you use the verb to be. Eliminating from language means you can't say sentences such as she is beautiful, he is smart, or even the simplest I am hungry. I believe that many of the phrases we say contain to be in some form. Although we can easily reword I am hungry as I feel hungry, but that's easy and doesn't greatly impact on how we feel about being or feeling hungry. But what about I am sick and I am feeling sick? This is very similar to what I pointed out in the recent program when I used the words my cancer as an example, which implies, of course, ownership, an ownership of something that you clearly do not want. Doing away with all forms of it does away with factual statements such as, this is a stupid idea. This sentence only illustrates how we express opinions as if they were established facts. Getting rid of to be helps us to remember that much of what we say represents, as a matter of fact, just opinions, our opinions. Listen to an alternative for this is a stupid idea, which could be, I utterly dislike this idea. Sounds different and feels different, doesn't it? If we do away with the verb to be, we could provide much more detail than usual. For instance, when rewording he is smart, we could end up with he scored 150 on his IQ test, or maybe he makes piles of money without actually working, depending on entirely on your definition of smart. We would less often use ambiguous words such as smart anyway, which helps expose any assumptions or interpretations behind them. Think about the statement, the earth is round. Notice how the verb to be, the earth is round, carries with it an intellectual momentum of completeness, finality, and time independence. It sounds like an absolute immutable truth, doesn't it? Yes, of course it does. Exactly like the statement, the Earth is flat just a few hundred years ago. The alternative construct, the Earth looks round, shows that an observer exists, an observer that simply perceives the Earth is round, and that this observer may have flaws in his perception. Losing this use of language brings back a certain humbleness, if you will, in language, getting rid of the God mode in speech, and reminds us that we make mistakes. I also would discourage abstractions that lead to labeling and to prejudice. Listen to "he is Christian" and compare it with "he believes in the existence of Christ." Well, these two sentences have more or less the same meaning, but really exactly the same meaning. Our new version avoids labeling and any prejudices associated with the label Christian. Labeling happens not only when dealing with other people, but with ourselves. If you find yourself saying, "I'm a pig," say now, "I eat like a pig." Or, going further still, "I ate twice as much as I usually do at dinner." What a difference! What a different feeling this creates! A definite advantage of using language in this way, without any form of "to be," is that you will notice that using passive voice can get really difficult. Once you get used to it, you won't miss using passive voice. Uncompromising statements such as "mistakes were made," you can rephrase as "he made a mistake." Or if you really don't know or don't want to expose the doer, the mistake doer, you could use "someone made a mistake." This statement still seems a superior alternative to the former, since you explicitly point out that a doer exists behind the action. What about if you saw a man reeking of whiskey stagger down the street and then collapse? You might think he is drunk. But now you could think instead he acts drunk, or he looks drunk. After all, you might have encountered an actor practicing the part of a drunken man, or a man who had spilled alcohol on himself because he had a seizure of some kind, and you could find another few possibilities. Instead of simply walking by, you might instead look a little bit carefully, a little bit closer, and end up sending for an ambulance, perhaps. I would now foster a worldwide view in which the user perceives situation as changeable rather than as static, and in which verbal formulations derived from experience indicate possibilities rather than certainties. Concerning our latest theme on health, Alfred Korzybski, whom I've quoted many times in past shows, many years ago proposed the non-elementalistic term semantic reaction. Remember, I spoke about it before. And he used it to label more accurately the complex cortico-thalamic psychophysiologic interplay typical of us as human beings. Research into this field has expanded greatly since Korzybski's time, which after all was in the 1930s. And now scientists use terms such as psychosomatic, psychoneuroendocrinology, and psychoneuroimmunology in their investigations into the mechanisms by which almost every aspect of our complex mind-body system affects almost every other aspect. Remember, I spoke about that, I think it was the show before last. Thus, thinking does not exist in isolation, as the way you think affects the way you feel, which affects the physiological functions of the endocrine and the immune system and all the other systems, other organs in our system. Words can and do profoundly affect many different aspects of the mental, emotional, and physiological biochemical complex that comprises our physical selves. Imagine what kind of impact a physician's words have when he declares, "You have cancer." Some of you may have heard these words already, and I, unfortunately, have heard them too. Or what about, "Your cancer has spread"? What about, "You have one more year to live"? Words that a dear friend of mine had heard. 6 years later, she is still alive because she translated these words into something much more useful for her. But how many people are there who heard these and similar statements, who could not rethink and who took these words at their face value? How many suffered because of that? How many died? After all, words can increase stress levels enormously, which means feeling upset, increased heart rate, adrenaline rush, and so on. It also means reduced immune system. Granted, your language may suffer if you have just taken your first steps in breaking your usual language pattern. However, with a little bit of practice, you'll notice that talking without "to be" provides an excellent opportunity for a much more vibrant and vigorous way of talking and writing. "You're wrong" easily turns into "I don't see it that way." This style of communication immediately opens the possibility for debate without the need to overturn the other person's statement first. Declarations such as "I like the movie" invite a healthy discussion and the sharing of different opinions, much more enticingly than the usual "the movie was good." We no longer deal with absolute truth, which do not exist anyway, but with perceptions. And perceptions never override each other and thus can never clash. What about creativity and problem solving? Firstly, it dissolves notions such as "there is no solution," turning them into superior choices such as "I haven't found any solutions yet." More than that, you overcome generalizations and get to the facts more objectively, enabling you to find solutions initially overlooked. After some reframing, meaning changing, "the customer is stupid" could become "the customer won't buy our product even though it costs less." The latter makes a much better starting point for coming up with solutions than the former. The label of being stupid seems finite. This is it. He is too stupid. End of the story. Go for it. It's an excellent brain exercise. It will be very challenging if you don't try it exactly like learning a new language, except that instead of learning new constructs, you must unlearn part of what you already know. It will fire up your neurons. However, this use of language should not stop you altogether from using "to be." In fact, many instances of "to be" don't present any problems. It should not be a grammar restriction, but should initiate a new way of thinking and bring a higher awareness on how language affects our thoughts and our actions, consequently. And it should not enforce a strict, blind limitation to language. I see it as developing new habits of thinking rather than with adhering to it rigidly. I've quoted Alfred Sobieski many times, and in Science and Sanity, he wrote, and I quote, "To achieve adjustment and sanity, and the conditions that follow from them, we must study the structural characteristics of this world first, and then only build languages of similar structure, instead of habitually ascribing to the world the primitive structure of our language, unquote. Language and thought are obviously closely, very closely related to one another, and this leads me to our mind being a trickster. Our mind set up many traps for us. Unless we are aware of them, these traps can seriously hinder our ability to think rationally, leading us to bad reasoning and making stupid decisions. Features of our minds that are meant to help us may eventually get us into trouble. And one of the first trap is the anchoring trap, over-relying on first thoughts. Is the population of Turkey greater than 35 million? What's your best estimate? Researchers asked this question to a group of people, and the estimates were seldom too far off 35 million. The same question was posed to a second group, but this time using 100 million as a starting point. Although both figures were arbitrary, the estimates from the 100 million group were without fail concomitantly higher than those in the 35 million group. For those who want to know the answer, it's about 75, 76 million. The lesson from it is your starting point can heavily bias your thinking. Initial impressions, ideas, estimates, or data anchor subsequent thoughts. This trap is particularly dangerous as it's deliberately used in many occasions, such as by experienced salesmen who will show you a higher priced item first, anchoring that price in your mind. So what can you do about it? Always view a problem from different perspectives. Avoid being stuck with a single starting point. Work on your problem statement before going down a solution path. Think on your own before consulting others. Get as much data as possible and explore some conclusions by yourself before getting influenced by other people's anchors. Seek information from a wide variety of sources. Get many opinions and broaden your frame of reference. Avoid being limited to a single point of view. This most certainly applies also to our health theme, and I have alluded to it in one of my recent programs on cancer. The second trap I'm talking about is the status quo trap. In one experiment, a group of people were randomly given one of two gifts. Half received a decorated mug, the other half a large Swiss chocolate bar. They were then told that they could effortlessly exchange one gift for the other. Logic tells us that about half of the people would not get the gift they preferred and would hence exchange it. But in fact, only 10% did. We tend to repeat established behaviors unless we are given the right incentives to entice us to change them. The status quo automatically has an advantage over every other alternative. What can you do about that? Consider the status quo as just one other alternative. Don't get caught in the current versus others mindset. Ask yourself if you would choose your current situation if it were not the status quo. Know your objectives, be explicit about them, and evaluate objectively as you can, if the current state of affairs serves them well. Avoid exaggerating switching costs. They frequently are not as bad as we tend to assume. The third trap is the protecting earlier choices. It's a sunk cost trap. You have consulted a therapist who treats you with very expensive so-called alternative medication. 6 months into the treatment, you don't feel any better than before. You regret now the fact that you consulted him in favor of conventional treatment or a different alternative treatment. What would you do? It may be hard to admit, but changing treatment would be the way to go. After all, 6 months down the line, no change. The money for the expensive alternative medication and the consultation costs is already gone. It's gone regardless of the alternative you choose. It's a sunk cost, and it shouldn't influence your decision. What can you do about it? And the first thing is to be okay with making mistakes. Examine why admitting to earlier mistakes distresses you. It is much, much better to admitting to it rather than to deny that it was a mistake and to continue, in this case, with a useless treatment. Nobody is immune to errors, so you shouldn't make a big deal of it. Do not berate yourself for it, but do not blame others either, not even the therapist. But praise yourself for acknowledging your error and that you have learned from it. Listen to people who were not involved in the earlier decision. Find people who are not emotionally committed to past decisions and ask their opinion. Focus on your goals. We make decisions in order to reach goals. Don't become attached to the particular series of steps you already took towards the goal. But consider how you can better fulfill that goal from now on. The fourth trap is the confirmation trap, seeing what you want to see. Let's take the example you feel the stock market will be going down and that now may be a good time to sell your stock. Just to be reassured of your hunch, you call a friend who has just sold all her stock to find out her reasons. Congratulations, you have just fallen into the confirmation trap. Looking for information that will most likely support your initial point of view while conveniently avoiding information that challenges it. This is also called cherry picking. This confirmation bias affects not only where you go to collect evidence, but also how you interpret the data. We are much less critical of arguments that support our initial ideas and much more resistant to arguments against them. No matter how neutral we think we are when first tackling a decision, our brains always decide intuitively on an alternative right away, making us subject to this trap virtually at all times. What can you do about it? Expose yourself to conflicting information. Examine all the evidence with equal rigor. Don't be soft on disconfirmatory evidence. Know what you are about, searching for alternatives or looking for reassurance. Get a devil's advocate. Find someone you respect to argue against the decision you're contemplating to make. If you can't find one, build the counter-arguments yourself. Always consider the other positions with an open mind, taking into account the other mind traps we are discussing here, by the way. Don't ask leading questions. When asking for advice, make neutral questions to avoid people merely confirming your biases. What should I do with my stock works better than should I sell my stock today? The same applies to our health theme too. You feel that your conventional treatment is not good enough, and you may be right there, and you seek help in the alternative sector. You have heard from somebody who that they knew somebody who was greatly helped by this one particular therapist. You contact this somebody, you ask him for it, and he puts you in touch with somebody else too, who was also successfully treated by this therapist. This is cherry picking again. And now you instantly make up your mind to book an appointment with this therapist. What you should have done is exactly the same what I gave you before. Examine, get information, get a devil's advocate, or build your own counter-arguments. come to my fifth trap, the incomplete information trap. Consider this. Harry is an introverted guy. We know that he's either a librarian or a salesman. Which one do you think he most probably is? Of course, we may be tempted to think he is almost certainly a librarian. Haven't we been conditioned to think of salesmen as having outgoing, if not pushy, personalities? Too bad. This reasoning may be dead wrong, or at least incomplete. This conclusion neglects the fact that salesmen outnumber librarians by 100-1. Before you even consider Harry's character traits, you should have assigned only a 1% chance that he is a librarian. That means that even if all librarians are introverted, all it takes is 1% of introverts among the salesmen to make the chances higher for Harry being a salesman. That's just one example of how overlooking a simple data element can make our intuitions go completely astray. We keep mental images, simplifications of reality that make us jump to conclusions before questioning assumptions or checking whether we have enough information. What can you do about it? Well, make your assumptions explicit. Don't take a problem statement as it is. Keep in mind that for every problem you are using implicit information, your assumption. It's usually not hard to check the validity of assumptions, but first you need to know what they are. Always favor hard data over mental simplifications. Our preconceptions, such as stereotypes, can be useful in many situations, but we should always be careful to not over-rely on them. When given a choice, always prefer hard data. Review your assumptions also in case of a severe illness. Your assumptions about the illness, about conventional healing methods, as well as about alternative ones. Information. Get information. The sixth trap is the conformity trap. Everybody else is doing it. In a series of experiments, researchers asked students in a classroom a series of very simple questions, and sure enough, most of them got the answers right. In another group, they asked the same questions, but this time there were also a number of actors posing as students. Purposefully, they pushed the wrong answers. This time round, many more students provided wrong answers based on the leads from the researchers' assistants, who were the actors. This herd instinct exists to different degrees in all of us. Even if we hate to admit it, other people's actions do heavily influence ours. We fear looking dumb. Failing along with many people is frequently not considered a big deal, but when we fail alone, we must take all the heat ourselves. There's always peer pressure to adopt the behaviors of the groups we are in. This tendency to conform is notoriously exploited in advertising. Businesses often sell us products not based on their features, but by showing how popular they are. Since others are buying it in droves, why would we not join them? Conformity is also one of the main reasons why, once a book makes it into a well-known bestseller list, it tends to lock in and continue there for a long time. People like to consume what everybody else is consuming. What can you do about it? Discount the influence of others. When analyzing information, shield yourself from others' opinions at first. This is the best way to decide without being subconsciously swayed by popular opinions. Once you have analyzed your conclusion, you can always find out opinions of others. Beware social proof. Always raise a flag when someone tries to convince you, arguing primarily on the popularity of a choice instead of on its merit. Be courageous. Be willing to overcome obstacles and defend your viewpoints despite their unpopularity. Don't be afraid to point out that the emperor wears no clothes. The seventh trap is the illusion of control trap, shooting in the dark. Have you noticed that the vast majority of lotto players pick their own numbers instead of using the sometimes available auto-pick option, where the point of sales terminal chooses the numbers for you? We all know that however the numbers are chosen doesn't change the chance of winning, so why the strong preference for picking our own numbers? Curiously, even in situations we very clearly cannot control, we still tend to irrationally believe that we can somehow influence results. We just love to feel in control. Of course, it is always easier to illustrate this trap with chance games, but the tendency to overestimate our personal control of events influences every aspect of our daily lives. Unfortunately, contrary to the lottery example, the outcomes of our decisions are usually complex and interconnected. I do not believe that we can control the results that we get. We can influence them to some lesser or greater degree, but we cannot control them. While some of the outcomes can be traced back to our own choices, part of them will surely remain the result of variables that are outside our influence. What can you do about it? Understand that randomness is part and parcel of life. Although it may be hard to fathom or even admit it, some things are just random, in the sense that you don't depend on your effort at all. Accept responsibility for the things you can influence, but know that for many others there is not much you can do. Better than assuming or expecting that every event is under your control is to consciously choose how you respond to them. Beware of superstitions. Consider how much of your decisions are based on things you cannot really explain. Make those unknowns explicit and put them under scrutiny instead of pretending you can control them. I have to have a sip of water quickly. Excuse me. Sorry about that, but I'm back again. The eighth trap I'm talking about is the coincidence trap. And we suck at probabilities. John Reilly is a legend. He won a 1-in-a-million chance lottery. Not once, but twice. That makes it a 1-in-a-trillion event, which means that the lottery is rigged, or maybe John must have been singled out by Lady Luck, right? No, not really. Let's try a little math. If throughout the years 1,000 lottery winners keep playing at least 100 times, attempting the miracle of winning it once more, that adds up to a non-negligible chance of 10% that someone will make it. This means that the miracle is not only possible, but given enough attempts, its likelihood increases to the point of becoming almost inevitable. Another classic example, it takes a group of only 23 people to make it more likely than not two of the people in this group share the same birthday, both day and month. That's how unintuitive probabilities are. What can you do about it? Don't over-rely on gut estimates. While they are useful many times, gut estimates will sometimes be way off the mark. make sure you properly discount their importance or that you understand the ramifications of trusting them. Beware of after-the-fact probabilities. One thing is the probability of someone having won the lottery twice, looking at it in retrospect. Another completely different thing is that a particular person chosen before the outcome wins it. That would indeed qualify as a one-in-a-trillion event and would make anyone seriously doubt the legitimacy of that particular lottery. Number 9 is a recall trap. Not all memories are created equal. What's your best guess for the probability of a randomly selected flight ending in a fatal crash? While many people grossly overestimate it, MIT studies show that in reality, these fatal accidents happen at a rate of only 1 in 10 million. The fact that people suck at estimating probabilities explains only partially this tendency to misestimate. If you ask the same questions right after a major airplane accident, be prepared for even more biased assessments. What happens is we analyze information based on experience, on what we can remember from it. Because of that, we are overly influenced by events that stand out from others, such as those with highly dramatic impact or very recent ones. The more special an event is, the greater the potential to distort our thinking. Of course, no one even bothers about the other 9,999,999 planes that arrive safely at their destinations. So there's nothing more natural than forgetting about them. What can you do about it? Get hard data. As usual, don't rely on your memory if you don't have to. Use it, of course, but always endeavor to find data that confirms or discounts your recollection as soon as possible. Beware of your emotions. When analyzing information, try to emotionally isolate yourself from it, at least temporarily. If you're analyzing an event, pretend it happened a long time ago or that it happened to someone else unrelated to you. Likewise, if asking for opinions, find people who are not emotionally involved with them or their consequences. Beware the media. The media is notorious for exaggerating the importance of certain events while conveniently neglecting others. Always evaluate information on its relevance and accuracy and not on how much exposure it gets. The last trap I'm talking about is the superiority trap. The average is above average. In a study, drivers were asked to compare their driving skills to other people in the experiment. Almost all the participants, namely 93%, rated themselves as above average. With few exceptions, people have much views of themselves. They overestimate their skills and capabilities, leading to many errors in judgment. After making ourselves aware of these many thinking traps, we may now become susceptible to falling into a new one, the belief that we are now immune to them. Of course, the first step to avoid thinking traps is awareness and constant vigilance. But beware. It's much, much easier to notice other than us. What to do about it? Be humble. Always remember that everyone has blind spots. Yes, that includes you and me too. Surround yourself with honest people, not yay-sayers, not people who tell you what they think you want to hear from them. However, having said all that, don't go overboard. All these thinking traps are inherent parts of us. They make us human. Don't get me wrong, I still think that knowing about our thinking traps is very useful. Just don't get too worked up about it. I have come to the end of this show. Thank you for listening. Go to my website, mindmattersonline.info. Mindmattersonline is one word. There you'll find my email address and then write to me. Your comments. For now I leave you with words by Theo van Gogh, and I quote, "My use of language is part and parcel of my message," unquote. Tune in again next week, same time, same day, same time. Goodbye.